I should mention that the accompanist for Mr. Bryant was his late wife, Lina Jane. Lina Jane died several months ago, a victim of cancer, and I know that Roger and his family would appreciate your prayers for their comfort. It's been obviously a difficult time for them. Both of them were obviously very talented musically and contributed a great deal to the quality environment that Ambassador University and Ambassador College was able to offer to their students. So I hope you enjoyed that piece. It certainly is an appropriate song and a selection of special music regarding the topic that we're going to discuss today, for we are going to pick up part two of the American Exceptionalism series. This will be the final part in the series where we discuss the promises to Abraham given to Ephraim and Manasseh. And, of course, as we consider the current plight of our nation in particular, can you imagine the serious nature of the circumstances we're facing and God's plea with ancient Israel? If my people, who are called by my name, would seek my face, would humble themselves, would pray, I would heal their land. Remember Nineveh. It happened. It's not unprecedented. But the direction that our nation and the world is going make that a very unlikely scenario. And yet, God's plea is clearly there and set to music by that beautiful song. Now, last time we explored the concept of American exceptionalism. By examining several aspects of our nation's history, its governing principles that may very well have contributed to some of our national and perhaps exceptional characteristics. We discussed the common law of England with its emphasis upon freedom, individual rights and responsibilities, human dignity, worth, and value. We also discussed the dramatic rise of Britain and America in the 19th century, and their prophesied demise as well. We looked at the miracle of Dunkirk, we looked at the Battle of Britain, and recognized that those two miraculous events helped pull Britain's feet from the fire, and by other events, and by sheer determination, and by God's intervention, surely, they were not defeated. They were able to rise above the destruction and accept the victory. And, of course, Germany was defeated. We also examined those promises that were given to Abraham so many years ago and noted that his very name means father of many nations. So this morning, we're going to take a look at a couple of elements that will, I hope, expand our understanding of American exceptionalism, in that America is an exceptional, even a remarkable nation, when you consider all of the elements that we're going to look at this morning, and of course, add that to the most important element, the unconditional promises that God made to Abraham and his direct intervention in the affairs of men, that have brought that great single nation and that great company of nations to the apex of their power and influence, and now we see their decline. It's sad, but it is definitely in process, and it was prophesied to occur, as were so many other events that are going to unfold in the near future and show the power of God's plan and purpose and his desire to intervene and bring peace to this earth. For without his intervention, peace is a complete impossibility. And all the more reason for us to be aware of the armor of God, as Peter was bringing out in his sermonette this morning, For Satan certainly is walking about as a roaring lion. He would like to devour us and take out a voice of reason, a voice that would point people to God and repentance and turning away from their wicked ways. And certainly that voice is going to have to be loud and clear to connect with today's world that is steeped in wickedness and perversion and distortion of God's truth in every way. It's hard to imagine a part of the world, a part of human culture and society that hasn't been touched and deteriorated and perverted and distorted by Satan and his minions, his soldiers, if you will, and his wavelength that has been broadcasting rebellion and disregard for God's laws and commandments since the Garden of Eden. Clearly, the kingdoms and the governments of men and their rulers, their kings, their presidents, their prime ministers are all helplessly caught up in Satan's world and can only produce governments that are inferior to the government of God. And no matter what form of government we concoct and come up with, all roads are still going to lead to Armageddon. The great confrontation between God and his adversary and ours, Satan, the devil. And when you realize the significance of the statue or the monument in Daniel 2, the image with the head of gold to the feet of iron mixed with clay, if you recall that image, it is representative of the major world-ruling governments that have governed humankind since the essential dawn of civilization. All of those governments represented by that image are brought to dust by a stone cut out without hands, hurtling through the universe, coming down to earth, hitting the image where? On its feet, and bringing the whole image down. That's, of course, the point at which the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. So as we discuss American exceptionalism, it is not with the intent of raising democracy or America's form of government or America as a nation above all other nations in terms of their perfection and their ability to rise above all of the inferior human attempts to govern ourselves and provide the perfect model. It is not the perfect model. If there's anything perfect about it, it is the perfection of God in his ability to fulfill his promise to human beings and to provide the great blessings to this nation and to other Western nations, but primarily to Britain and the Company of Nations and this great single nation, America, in response to Abraham and his obedience. However, these blessings promised to Abraham were really unconditional. And God followed through and blessed Israel despite their rebellion. He punished them 7 times, remember? He punished them 7 times. If a day for a year in prophecy is accurate, that's 2,520 years from the point of Israel's fall until the rise of Britain and America. 2,520 years comes to approximately 1800, the Louisiana Purchase, the rise of Britain as a great merchant power, a great colonial power. The sun never sets on the British Empire, etc., etc. And the Commonwealth of Nations is still in place. And, of course, there's still a throne in England. Remember, the scepter would not depart from Judah. So the lawgiver is not going to depart. The scepter is not going to depart. That promise is intact. That promise is encased, if you will, in the throne of England. The 3 overturns that Jeremiah references, all of the information that Mr. Armstrong brought out so clearly in his book, The U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, all of that comes into play as well. So when I speak of American exceptionalism, I don't mean that America is perfect. God is perfect. And the blessings and the miracles He has wrought to fulfill those blessings are truly remarkable to behold and to see our nation go down and to see the blessings that have been given to us and promised to us misused and abused, cast off and recklessly applied. It's very shameful and a very difficult time in our lives when we know the truth and we know what lies ahead, when we know what could have been, what should have been, and compare it to what is and what is going to come. We should have a healthy appreciation for what God did for our nation and why our nation is currently in the malaise and the difficulty that it's in, and why the decline is going to continue. It's all prophesied. It's all a part of God's plan. And yet it is interesting to note the elements that made this nation and the mother nation of this nation, if you will, Great Britain, the great powers that they were. There are some things that we can identify, that we can recognize, and we will this morning, that are scripturally based and gave these nations their edge and the opportunity to shine and to excel. However, I again want to emphasize that politics, politicians, troubled asset relief programs or TARP programs will all prove to be futile in the long run. Isaiah 1 gives a shockingly clear description of modern day Israel. Remember what it says? From the head to the foot, the whole body is sick. And the rulers of Sodom, the men of Gomorrah, are addressed in chapter 2. So not only do we find that there are physical difficulties such as drought and famine and pestilence and plague, but there are immoral issues. So much so that modern Israel is referred to as Sodom and Gomorrah in Isaiah chapter 2. So this afternoon, I would like to focus on factors that have contributed to America's exceptionalism, its uncommon and unique position in the world and in history. A nation set apart by its geography, its ideology, its founding documents, its people, set apart by their proclaimed desire to become a melting pot of nations. Do you remember that phrase? That comes from many decades ago when people were streaming in here on ships. They were coming to Ellis Island. They were looking at Lady Liberty. Remember the song, "Give Us Your Tired, Your Poor, Your Huddled Masses Yearning to Be Free"? What a concept. And it's on that concept that this nation was built. Various ethnic groups migrating and immigrating from countries all across Europe and all around the world for that matter, coming to America where you could actually own property, where you were free to pursue your hopes and your dreams, free to travel all over the country. It was a remarkable country. And we're going to take a look at how remarkable it really was back in those years. And I'd like to do so by reading an introductory paragraph or two written by Henry Reeve. He was introducing a translation of de Tocqueville's, Alexis de Tocqueville's, Democracy in America. How many of you are familiar with de Tocqueville? I am going to definitely pick this up in the future and read it. De Tocqueville was only 30 years old when he wrote Democracy in America. He was a Frenchman who came over and wanted to examine what the secrets were to America's success. And I want to read the introduction that was written here to the translation of Democracy in America by John T. Morgan. He was a judge, and this was written back in 2005, I believe. This was a rather recent translation of this work that was written actually in the 1830s. That's when de Tocqueville came to America to study democracy. So let's read it. In the 11 years that separated the Declaration of Independence of the United States from the completion of that act and the ordination of our written Constitution, 11 years between 1776, of course, and the signing of our Constitution, the great minds of America were bent upon the study of the principles of government that were essential to the preservation of the liberties which had been won at great cost and with heroic labors and sacrifices. And of course, speaking of the Revolutionary War, and speaking of the French Republic and the wars that they had just encountered, and the bloody skirmishes that were all over Europe, the oppressive governments that seemed to populate Europe and even England at the time, to the point where people were exiting for the New World, what was one of the primary reasons the pilgrims came? Religious freedom. They wanted to establish a nation that would give them the freedom to worship as they pleased. There would be no national church. But now, the protection of all Americans to worship as they will has turned into protection from religion. How dare you have a religious persuasion or perception? That's discriminatory. And so we have turned these principles on their ears, if you will, and we are not really pursuing the principles on which this nation was founded as we once did. But that's, of course, another story. Their studies, that's the studies of America's founders and the writers of the Constitution, were conducted in view of the imperfections that experience had developed in the government of the Confederation, that is the 11-year period between the Declaration and the Constitution, and they were therefore practical and thorough. When the Constitution was thus perfected and established, a new form of government was created, but it was neither speculative nor experimental as to the principles upon which it was based. If they were true principles, as they were, the government founded upon them was destined to a life and an influence that would continue while the liberties it was intended to preserve should be valued by the human family. So they had very high ideals. Very high ideals when they created the Constitution and, of course, the Declaration. And to the credit of the crafters of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, all men are created equal and endowed by evolution, endowed by their creator, right, with certain inalienable rights or rights that cannot be taken from them. And when you read in Scripture of these principles that God intended men to govern themselves with under His overall tutelage and guidance, because the government of God was in place in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve says, uh-uh, to God, and uh-huh, to the snake, and off we ran. And God's government will come back, but there are principles invoked in the Scripture, which, if followed, and many of them were entrenched in the language of the Constitution and the Declaration. And I suggest that many of these biblical principles gave rise to the success and the overwhelming dominance of America of the past. Sadly, not the present. Those liberties have been wrung from reluctant monarchs in many contests in many countries, and were grouped into creeds established in ordinances sealed with blood in many great struggles of the people. They were not new to the people. They were consecrated theories, but no government had been previously established for the great purpose of their preservation and enforcement. Do you recall the Gettysburg Address? What was the last statement? That government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth or the face of the earth. Lincoln knew the odds, and he knew what was going to happen if the government crumbled, if the Union failed. And certainly many miracles occurred in that situation as well that brought our nation out, and not the least of which was the miracle of a man like Lincoln being available to take the helm at that time. That's not taking anything away from God and His intervention. But without God, can you see how impossible it would have been to survive? And can you see how with God's intervention and the fulfillment of the promises He gave to Abraham, the great nation and the great company of nations rose to preeminence and dominance? That which was experimental in our plan of government was the question whether democratic rule could be so organized and conducted that it would not degenerate into license and result in the tyranny of absolutism without saving to the people the power so often found necessary of repressing or destroying their enemy when he was found in the person of a single despot. Well, the single enemy is Satan the devil. And our freedom, quote unquote, is becoming our master. And the freedoms that we are now allowing and espousing, that go contrary to the laws and commandments of God will eventually enslave us and chain us and take us into captivity. That's where we're going, because we have not listened to God. We have not followed God. We have not heeded God. We have not humbled ourselves and prayed. And we'll read more of Lincoln in our conclusion. When in 1831 Alexis de Tocqueville came to study democracy in America, the trial of nearly half a century of the working of our system had been made, and it had been proved by many crucial tests to be a government of liberty regulated by law. Yes, liberty and freedom with responsibility. Regulated by law, not oppressed by a burgeoning bureaucracy that is going to enforce equality. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. With such results in the development of strength in population, wealth, and military and commercial power as no age had ever witnessed. In other words, de Tocqueville and others in Europe saw the rise of America and were so enthralled by it, so shocked and amazed by it, he wanted to go over there and see it for himself and write about it. And he was an aristocrat, a 30-year-old French aristocrat, an excellent writer by every indication, and perfectly capable of putting down in writing what he witnessed and saw. And you've probably heard many quotes from him over the years, and it is quite an interesting read. And I hope you will join me in picking it up, because I think it is quite enlightening. Well, now I'd like to go to some of the biblical principles that I mentioned earlier and discuss those with you in terms of how they lent themselves to helping America become the exceptional nation that it indeed did become. I'm just going to review briefly a couple of things that we mentioned in the first sermon. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, if a man will not work, he should not eat. And most, at least people of my generation, grew up in homes with parents who grew up in the Great Depression era. And during that time, food was scarce, jobs were scarce, money was scarce, everything was scarce. My grandmother saved everything. My grandmother saved string. My grandmother saved tinfoil. Every time you gave her something new, it would go up on the shelf. When she died, we took out new appliances and so many new things that she never opened because she was going to wear out what she had first. My grandmother cooked on a wood stove. It was fired by corn cobs. And she did that till the day she died in 1974. She was still cooking on a wood stove. Hard work was a part of life. The computer generation, the internet had not yet been created. Desk jobs, I think, were probably sort of a rarity. Can you imagine what it took to build the thousands of airplanes and tanks and all of the armaments and munitions that were sent by the United States over to England in World War II? And the incredible amount of energy and national strength that it took to muster all of that. It took a lot of work. This nation was built on a very strong worth ethic. If a man will not work, he should not eat. That's what the Apostle Paul said. Now, there's a difference between willing not to work and being unable to work, right? A big difference. So I want to make that clear, as the Scripture does. The importance of work and productive labor illustrated by God Himself at creation. He worked for 6 days. I don't know how tired He was at the end. My tongue's in my cheek. I don't know if God gets tired. I doubt it. He doesn't have to eat. He doesn't have to sleep. So He worked for 6 days and rested on the Sabbath. Why do you think He did that? I think He did it to set an example. You notice what the commandment reads? 6 days shall you work. Now, I'm not about to say, look, I want to take a poll. How many of you that are working work 6 days? How many don't work 6 days? Okay, well, you need to work 6 days. Talk to your employer and work six. No, I'm not saying that. The work ethic is what I'm emphasizing. 6 days shall you work, the seventh day you rest. And human nature tends to look at what God says and they say, I'm going to do something else. Maybe I'll work a little, maybe I'll rest when I want to, maybe I'll do whatever I please. But the principle is, you work for 7 days, you rest for seven. The seventh day, rather. You have 6 days to do what you want to do. Work, play, enjoy, whatever, but on the Sabbath, it's different. In Leviticus 19, we read about the command in ancient Israel to vineyard owners to leave the corners. You ever watch a combine harvest a field? How many of you have ever seen a big combine at work? They don't kind of swing around into the corner and leave grain in the field. Have you ever seen any grain left in the field? The only grain you'll see left in the field is what little that actually falls on the ground. We're talking about $300,000 and $400,000 machines that drive through the field and take a huge swath, and when they get done, there's really no grain left. That's not what God said you should do. You leave the corners for the poor and those who need help, because the poor, how long will they be with us? The poor will always be with us. And the thing is, one day you and I might join them. They're always going to be with us. That is not a pejorative term. It's just the reality of the human condition. He said, leave the corners so that people like Ruth, remember Ruth? When her and Naomi came back into their land and they had nothing, what did Ruth do? She went out and gleaned in the fields and picked up the grain. Now, Boaz kind of liked Ruth right from the start and gave her a few extra bags of grain, and Naomi was excited and all of that. But you see, God's way provides for the poor, provides a way for them to work to glean from the field. And in that context, work should be a very important part of every able-bodied person's life, especially men who are charged with the responsibility of caring for and meeting the needs of their families. And even those roles have been transformed. But that's another sermon. Maybe I'll get another chance. Now, I want to look at Matthew 25, which to me is one of the most detailed descriptions of what you might call free enterprise, dare I say capitalism, simply a discourse on making money and dealing with money in the workplace, in the business world. It's a fascinating parable. And I'd like to just bring out a few highlights. Verse 14, Matthew 25, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them." Now, this man was apparently quite wealthy. He delivered talents, which of course are measures of money and funds. I won't go into what each talent was worth, but it was a substantial amount at that time. To one he gave 10 talents, to one he gave 5 talents, to one he gave 1 talent. So the master was discerning. He determined that there were various skill levels and various abilities among his servants, and he was going to give 10 talents to one. I suggest that he thought, yes, this is probably my most skilled investor. And then he gave 5 talents to the second one. He's skilled, but I don't know if I want to entrust him with as much. Then he gave 1 talent to somebody else. So the master is an investor. You know, I wonder if he had a lot of money and invested, let's say, in different companies. What if he, again, you could bring this principle down to a lot of different situations in our current economic circumstance, where corporations or individuals own a number of companies and they give other people responsibilities to run the company. In fact, what did God give Adam and Eve? Dominion over the earth. He said, "Be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth." Do you think that only meant have children? Or do you think that meant take care of the investment and the product that I've given you? I have given you something very valuable and very important. I want you to take care of it. I want you to multiply it. I expect a return on my investment. Because, in fact, the man traveling to a far country is a type of Jesus Christ. And even he has a supervisor, if you will, God the Father. And we have all been given talent, if you will. It's nice that we have kind of a crossover in the English language. We have talents and skills, and we've been given physical blessings. We've been given money. We've been given energy. We've been given life. God has invested in us. He has given us things. And Christ, our elder brother, has blessed us. And he has gone back to heaven. He's going to come again. And he's going to what? He's called us to account. We'll have to explain what we did with what we've been given. Be it our physical talents and skills, or be it the physical blessings that we have. How have we used the money, the talent, if you will, the energy, the enthusiasm, the life, the skills, the knowledge that God has given us? Have we multiplied it? Have we invested it well? Or have we not? You see, all of it plays in. But what we're talking about here is, you might say, the free enterprise system and how you have your talents, you have your skill, you have your energy, you have the freedom to do what you want to do with what God has given you. How will you manage it? And that's what, in a sense, built this country. Now, that doesn't mean there's not avarice and greed. Read the story of the Transcon Railroad and the money-grabbing tactics that were used there. Check out some of the scams that have been undertaken over the years. Bernard Madoff, for instance, and all of the other situations where human nature and greed and corruption and violence take over, and it's no longer respect for individuals. It's no longer life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for every human being. It's how much can I gather together for myself, and I don't care what happens to those below me, beneath me, around me, above me. I don't care. So it's not perfect, but I'm speaking to principle here. And to one he gave 5 talents, another 2, another 1, to each according to his own ability. A discerning manager, if you will. He knew that each of these individuals had different skills. Then he who had received the 5 talents went out and traded with them and made another 5. So I was wrong earlier. I said 10. He eventually had 10. He gave 5 away. He gave 2 and he gave 1. And he let them manage that resource. And God, again, everybody is not equal. Everybody is not created equal in terms of their individual talents, skills, intelligence, strengths, weaknesses, health, education, and upbringing. There are dozens of variables. We all have equal opportunity. But now, it seems that, well, the opportunities are not equal enough. So let's call in the government to equalize the opportunities for everybody. How successful has that been? All I can say is I'm very grateful that the government does not own General Motors. Would you like to drive a car built by a government-owned car company? Not me. But this is where our government is going. Bigger and bigger and bigger. And our current president is interested in redistribution of wealth. And we'll see what happens to that concept here in this parable. You see that he who was given 2 gained 2 more also. But now the one who went and who got 1 talent dug a hole in the ground and buried his Lord's money. So, after a long time, verse 19, the Lord of these servants came and settled accounts with them. So, the master was able to accrue this wealth. And there are some wealthy individuals in this world. And in some cases, they abuse their wealth. In other cases, they are generous with their wealth. In other cases, they have shared their wealth. They have given their wealth to others who have multiplied that wealth. And it multiplies in more jobs and more opportunities and all the rest of it. It's called free enterprise. With a minimal amount of government intrusion and a maximum amount of freedom and liberty to pursue your own dreams, your own ideas, your own businesses, and to work in pursuit of happiness. And of course, God gives other financial laws. We'll talk about some of those as we go through here. We all know how this story ends, but I want to point out a couple of things. To the first servant who had 5 and doubled, the Lord said to him in verse 21, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord." This is a parable that's designed to describe the kingdom of God. Enter into the kingdom of God. I'm backing off to a physical application. Well done. You invested those 5 talents. Now I have 5 more talents. So the benefit was great. The servant was commended. He did an excellent job with what he'd been given. And it was a long time. and apparently had freedom to invest and to do whatever he wanted to do with those talents. And the master was very pleased when he returned and said, you are going to be ruler over many cities since you've been faithful in these little things, in money and in wealth, and what you did with what I gave you. You see, we have all been given a stake, if you will, something of great value, be it our life, our talents and skills, our energy, our money, our physical blessings, our family, all of it. God expects us to multiply and use that to His glory and to His honor according to His laws and commandments. And that's why we want to hear, well done, you good and faithful servant. The one who had two doubled his. He too was commended. But the one individual who got one talent, what did he say? Well, you know, he unwrapped and said, here it is. I knew you were a hard person. I knew you reaped where you hadn't sown, which is to imply, I knew that you kind of took advantage of people, that you weren't willing to go out there and plant, but you came in and reaped the harvest and took the bounty of the increase like you're going to do with those other guys that multiplied it. Well, I'm not going to play that game. I'm suggesting some things. I'm speculating. But I suspect that this is a fairly accurate picture of the attitude of an individual like this, who is almost putting his master in judgment for giving him the talent. Here it is, just as you gave it to me. And I wonder, again, in an economic sense, should that person prosper equally? I don't think so. How hard did he work? How hard was it to dig the hole? How long did it take him? At least he knew where the talent was when his master came back. Well, what did the master have to say? His Lord answered, verse 26, and said, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. In other words, what's wrong with investing? What's wrong with providing an opportunity for other people to plant and to grow and to harvest, and then you reap some of the benefits? What is wrong with that? What is wrong with that? There can be things wrong with it if it's misapplied, if human nature gets involved and you become greedy and lustful and selfish. There was nothing wrong with it according to the master or the Lord of the house. Now notice verse 27. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers at my coming. I would have received back my own with interest. Interest? Invest him? Of course. Now, you know there's a prohibition in the Old Testament against charging interest to your brother. If your brother is in need, he needs food, he needs a loan to plant his crop or whatever, you say, well, yeah, I'll give you something, but I want to charge interest. I want to make money on my brother who's in dire need. Not good. Not godly. God doesn't like that. You know why he doesn't like that? Because he took a enslaved people out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of bondage, brought them into the promised land, gave them everything, saw to their every need, and then they, as his people, turn around and charge interest to one of their brothers who is hungry? Not a good idea. God was not pleased with that. And you can understand why. But I want you to notice what happens here. Verse 28, take the talent from him, the one who buried it, that one talent, and give it to the guy to whom I only gave two, because now he has four, and one more would give him five, and why should I give that one talent to the guy who already made 10? That doesn't make sense. I want to be fair, so I'm... Of course, I misread that, didn't I? Where did the talent go? Where did the one talent go? To the servant who had doubled the five. So do you reward someone that went above and beyond? And to those who didn't perform as well? Should they be able to cry out and say, that's not fair? Give me more? But what are we hearing more and more of in our modern economy today? Well, that's not fair. It's not fair that Warren Buffett is rich. The Wall Street Journal has a lot of stories about Warren Buffett, and they had another one in there this morning. His two young picks for his successors, you know, he's 88. And he was disappointed because he didn't meet his investment goal last year. I'm not crying too much for Mr. Buffett. He seems to be just a regular guy. But anyway, his two hand-picked successors outpaced him by a substantial margin, and the company is still doing very well. But you know, in terms of investment and making money and sharing the wealth and managing it and using it in a godly fashion, look at the opportunities this nation offers. As opposed to Maoist China or Communist Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, the French Revolution. Can you see why people fled Europe by the hundreds, if not the thousands, and came to a land of promise and opportunity? Where if you cut down a few trees and plant some corn, the government would cede to you 50 acres, you'd have a homestead. You could actually own land. And you held the title, not the king. So, lots of things. Taxation without representation. Remember that one? And now we have taxation with representation. And it's going to, of course, increase. Well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it, as you look at those principles. Now, there are many other areas we could turn to. You know, Malachi 3, verse 8, will a man rob God? You know, when you first think about that question, what's your answer? No, I would never think of that, robbing God. How could I ever rob God? I mean, what does he have that I would want? I mean, I've earned everything I have. I'm not supposed to rob from my neighbor. I'm not supposed to rob a bank. But how can I rob from God? No way. Well, what does Malachi say? Well, God, through the prophet Malachi, says, yet you have robbed me. How? In tithes and in offerings. What did Christ say? Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Now, who determines what belongs to Caesar? Well, sadly, Caesar does. But we're to render to Caesar what he claims as his. And, on the other hand, what did Christ say? You render unto God the things that are God's. Our nation has robbed God. And to think that the giver of every good gift and the bounty he bestowed upon our exceptional nation has largely been taken by the people and nothing given in return is a very sad commentary on our exceptional nation, isn't it? Let's turn to another in Galatians chapter 6. There are many ways to apply this principle. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. You see, this is a principle. You will reap what you sow. How hard are you going to work? How much energy and effort are you going to put into the crop? And even then, soil conditions, weather, quality of seed, weeds, fertilizer, moisture, etc. Some of these elements you can control, others you can, but the principle remains. You will reap what you have chosen to sow, and you are expected to accept responsibility for the outcome. You will reap what you have sown. And if what I have sown is not adequate to support me and sustain me once I reap it, then who is responsible for taking care of me? Is somebody else responsible for me, or am I responsible for me? With freedom comes personal responsibility. And I'm afraid that that's something our nation, generally speaking, may have lost sight of down through the decades and the centuries. We are responsible for ourselves. Not our parents, not our government, not our siblings, our friends, or our boss. Now, this is not to say that we might not be in need at some time and need some assistance. I'm speaking to principle. Who is responsible for me? I am responsible for me. Can you imagine what a difference it would make in our nation if everyone accepted responsibility for themselves instead of pushing it to someone else, some other entity? It's something to consider. 1 Timothy chapter 6. For the love of money, New King James Version, is a root of all kinds of evil. Absolutely it is. And I don't mean to tout the perfection of capitalism or the perfection of free enterprise. But I do mean to emphasize the godly principles that are involved in some of these concepts and the principles that did contribute to the building of this nation by men and women who were committed to working, men and women who were committed to taking responsibility for themselves and teaching that responsibility to their children. Note, in this chapter, we're going to read about the relationship between godliness, contentment, and gain. For we brought, verse 7, nothing into this world. You see why the parable of the talents is so telling? Yeah, you kind of come into the world, you have nothing, and God gives you something. What do you do with it? You come into the world with nothing, and you leave the same way, don't you? Now, people have tried. People have been buried in their cars. People have had money and personal effects placed in their coffin. Still didn't work. Not the way you'd like it to work. Verse 8, and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Oh, don't you wish it were so? Are you and I content with that? I know I'm not. I should be, and I try to be most of the time, but I know me. Just think, there will come a time when having food and clothing will be very much appreciated and will be more than adequate to satisfy us. But when you're surrounded by Sam's, Bel Air, Safeway, and all the other stuff we're surrounded with, how difficult is it to be content with food and clothing? Doesn't even say anything about shelter. But obviously, you need shelter. Verse 6, godliness with contentment is great gain. Think about it. Godliness plus contentment equals great gain. How about gain plus godliness equals contentment? Wouldn't we rather have that one? I want to gain a lot of things, then I'll be godly because I have all this stuff and I'll thank God for all this stuff, and then I'll be content. But until I have gain with godliness, no, it's godliness with contentment. That's the great gain. The other is superfluous. It's secondary. It augments your life. It doesn't make your life. And that's the danger I think we have to be aware of and be on guard against. Now, the last example I'll turn to, Leviticus chapter 25. This speaks of the Jubilee. And in ancient Israel, what year was the Jubilee year? The 50th, Leviticus 25. And of course, you could give several sermons on the concepts involved in the Jubilee year. You had a land rest every seventh year, right? Where nothing was planted. So if you have 7 times 7, that's 49. So you have a land rest in the 49th year. You have a land rest in the 50th year. What does that mean? Ooh, food supply is low. Unless God blesses you, which he did. And for 2 years, it was undoubtedly, in all of Israel, a celebratory time where families and tribes and cities got together and shared what they had and celebrated the generosity of God. And if down through that 50-year period, you had a bad year and you lost your property, guess what? The property came back to your family. It was the great leveling process. It was the great opportunity for a fresh start and a new life that God gave Israel. It was something like bankruptcy, you might say, but not exactly like it. It was the great reset, and everything sort of went back to the way God originally handed off the land and gave land to the different groups. But notice, verse 23, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. So God owned the land, but he did allow them to trade it and to exchange it for money. But in the 50th year, the Jubilee year, it went back to the original owners, if you will. And it's a lot more complex than that, but suffice it to say that God built that in. So if you made mistakes, there were difficulties, all was not lost. But of course, that system is not in place today. So clearly, many of these principles were used in forging our founding documents. They contributed to our exceptional nature as a nation, a land of unique promise, abundance, and opportunity. And I would say that perhaps no other president, as I mentioned earlier, no other president in our history has so fully grasped or captured in words our unique national position or exceptionalism, if you will, than Abraham Lincoln. And I would like to read his words, a quotation from his proclamation appointing a national fast day dated March 30th, 1863, in the midst of the Civil War. Can you imagine declaring a national day of fasting in the United States today? I dare say even Abraham Lincoln could not pull it off. I don't think so. But listen to these powerful words in the context of what we discussed this morning. And insomuch as we know that by his divine law, nations like individuals are subjected to punishments and chastisements in this world, may we not justly fear that the awful calamity of civil war, which now desolates the land, may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins, to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. Can you believe it? The President of the United States indicating that the civil war may in fact be God's punishment for our nation. As he says, a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins and for the end result of a national reformation as a whole people. Whoa. Can you imagine verbiage like that echoing from the President's State of the Union address? When's that coming up? A couple of weeks? We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. This did not just happen. If you ever travel overseas and you see what other nations have by comparison, in terms of natural resources and blessings and land and opportunity, you will, like Alexis de Tocqueville, be amazed. I have been in my travels. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. And if he could say that yesterday, 1863, what would he say today? 2014. Do these words not echo with truth? We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. Stunning, isn't it? Startling. How true are those words today? And to think that he would describe our nation as exceptional at that point, not even having seen the dramatic leap forward following World War II. So all the more reason to listen carefully to the words of Abraham Lincoln. But sadly, we are witnessing the consequences of our national choices as they take their toll upon our country, upon Britain, and upon the Western democracies as well. It is clear that we are following in the steps of ancient Israel, a nation who lost its land and its identity, or its exceptional status, if you will, because of rebellion, indifference, disobedience. I'd like to close in Luke chapter 21, verse 36. Luke 21, verse 36. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And as we read this verse, as we watch and pray, let us not forget the parable of the talents. We are going to stand before the Son of Man. He is going to request an accounting. So while we watch and pray, we must be at work, multiplying our talents and abilities, using the blessings God has given us, providing him a return on his investment, and doing all that we do to glorify the body, to glorify God and edify the body, I should say, and at the same time, be a part of that bride, that unified bride, that will come to the altar with Jesus Christ, if you will, be wedded upon his return, and enjoy the benefits of the kingdom of God forever.